Hello and welcome to episode 17 of the Not Just a Lawyer podcast. Today I'm going to give you a short and sweet introduction into a really interesting topic, which is fitness to plead and its corollary, fitness to be tried. I'm recording this podcast on the traditional lands of the Ngunnawal people, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present. So fitness to plead and its twin question of fitness to be tried are things that come up in the mind of lawyers when they're dealing with defendants in criminal matters. So this is another criminal law type topic. It's different from the thing that we see on TV and the movies where courts are looking at, oh my God, was this person insane when they committed this offence? Do they have an insanity defence available? Nope, it's not that. It's a really practical question. It is, can my client understand the charges against them enough to enter a plea of either guilty or not guilty? And when you look at fitness to be tried, are they fit to be tried? Can they understand the trial process and things like that? And so there's some really big red flags that crop up for me when I'm dealing with clients that make me think of, gosh, I'd better have a look at whether they are fit to plead and fit to be tried. And I'd like to talk briefly about what those are, and then I will take you to the leading case on this particular matter. It can actually be a lot drier than it sounds. It sounds like it's a really sexy, interesting topic, but actually it's pretty sort of straightforward and fairly crisp. So let's look at what might make someone like me worried about my client and whether they're fit to plead or to stand trial. Well, the first clue that I might get is from listening to my client. I might ask them questions about the matter. I might be asking them to repeat back to me what they understand, perhaps about, do they understand what they're charged with? Do they understand what a court process is? Do they understand what the evidence is against them? If they can't tell me in a way that makes me think they at least have a bare understanding of what's going on, that's obviously a huge red flag. I often encounter clients who are from vulnerable positions in society, so perhaps they're children, or perhaps they're mentally unwell, or perhaps they're socioeconomically not doing so well, or a lot of the time I might actually be given their medical history, or at least parts of it. So things in that might give me a bit of a clue that I might be dealing with someone who perhaps may not be fit to plead. For example, with children, I might be asking them questions as I usually would, and the answers that I get back make me worried that perhaps they don't understand at all what's going on. Similarly, with some people who are mentally ill, if someone were giving me answers that showed that they were in the grip of a psychosis, so things that were obviously not true, and I'll talk about some examples arising in the leading case of Kesavaraja. So in that case, the defendant in that matter was saying things like he was the incarnation of the god Vishnu, and also that aliens had been communicating with him. So if I were receiving information from my client of that nature, I would be very concerned, not only for their health in general, but also about their fitness to plead and to be tried. Likewise, if people are really quiet, often they're just nervous, but sometimes they're being quiet and giving very short answers to questions because they don't want you to know that they're actually really struggling with the cognitive processes involved in answering your questions, and they're hoping to slip under the radar if they give you the bare minimum back. They're hoping that you won't notice the amount of difficulty that they're having. Now, you might be gathering that everything I've just said then, except for the exception of the florid psychosis, is pretty subjective. You might be thinking, whew, you might be very lucky to work that out. And you're absolutely right. I've had a lot of clients who I build a good rapport with them, and so they do answer my questions. And so I understand what they're thinking and doing to the best extent that anyone can understand what someone else is thinking and doing. But in really serious matters, it is very common to get a report on fitness to plead just to make sure. And quite a lot of the time I am surprised about the, for example, cognitive difficulties that sometimes get raised in these reports, or other issues that crop up in them that aren't the sort of thing that a layperson like me, you know, however patient I am and however experienced I am at dealing with people, but they're things that a layperson like me just won't predict. And often this is the case if you get clients to undergo neuropsychological testing, which is where you're really looking at their cognitive function, you might find that your clients are actually quite impaired and they've been able to function out in society quite well, either by way of fairly solid routines or taking on jobs that have fairly routine components to them, and just, as I said, giving pretty short answers to questions so that they slip under your radar. You know, sometimes when you develop a good rapport with people as well, they'll talk to you a bit more than they will to others, but sometimes that actually can give you a bit of a false picture of the level of their functioning. It's definitely done that to me in the past. I've thought that people were much more intelligent than they actually were, than the cognitive testing revealed. And I'll just say as an aside, I do not for one moment think that the people where that has happened were trying to perform poorly on the tests. They have validity scales involved with them. So I think actually, perhaps because of the trust and perhaps feeling a bit more relaxed with me, there was perhaps less of a mental load on their cognitive processes. Whereas with people that they're not very familiar with, things are a lot harder. And if you think ahead to the process of a trial and the huge stress that that puts everyone involved under, not just the accused person, but, you know, anyone who comes in as a witness, the prosecutors, the defense lawyers, even the judges and jury, that's going to be an incredibly stressful situation. So you have to imagine that someone's capacity in those circumstances might be a bit worse than it would be under ordinary circumstances. So just to pull that all back to the issue now of being fit to plead or fit to stand trial, there is a leading case which discusses this, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. Before we get into that case, I mentioned before that I sought reports from experts to tell me about someone's fitness to plead. And I'm thinking that a bit later in this series, I will do a standalone episode on experts and how they're used in the law and certain things relating to them. So the main case that we're going to be talking about is called Kesavaraja, and it's a High Court of Australia case. And in that case, the court quoted with approval some standards which are known as the presser criteria. Presser as in he was a presser of flowers. How delightful. That's not what he actually was, but the case is named presser, and so it's called the presser criteria. So there are minimum standards that a person needs to have before they can be tried without having unfairness or injustice arise, and those standards are the ability to understand the nature of the charge, to plead to the charge, and to exercise the right of challenge. Now, that actually means to exercise the right of challenging particular jurors. So like you see on movies, people saying, no challenge, I'll accept that person. So basically the right to challenge certain members of a jury to be on the jury so that you have a fair hearing. The other element is to understand the nature of the proceedings. That is that it is an inquiry as to whether the accused committed the offence they're charged with. They're also required to know, to be able to follow the course of the proceedings, and also to understand the substantial effect of any evidence that might be given in support of the prosecution, and also to be able to make a defence or to answer the charge. So there's quite a lot of things they have to be able to understand. I'll run through those again. Understand the nature of the charge, able to plead to the charge and exercise the right of challenge, able to understand the nature of the proceedings, that is, it's an inquiry about whether they committed the offence that they're charged with, the ability to follow the course of the proceedings, and the ability to understand the substantial effect of any evidence that may be given in support of the prosecution, and the ability to make a defence or answer the charge. Now, that's a fairly high bar, it might sound like, because a lot of us would think, shivers, I don't know that I'd understand the nature of evidence against me. I'm not sure if I would fully understand the proceedings. But when experts look at this, they look at the person in front of them. They do a really long interview with them, generally speaking. They might do objective testing, or they might look at the person's medical history, which often sets out a great deal about the sort of treatments that they've had, the symptoms they have, because sometimes when people are talking to experts, they're not in a position where they can properly remember things if they're particularly unwell. Sometimes they've had head injuries and other things that affect their recall, and sometimes they just find it very hard to express themselves. So having some kind of objective background material is pretty helpful for the experts a lot of the time. So they're looking at all of these things in order to form their view, but the bar isn't hugely high. So while I say fairly seriously that a lot of us might struggle to understand some of these things, an accused person pretty much needs a bare minimum of understanding. And it's also taken into account that the court can change its procedure a little bit to make sure that elements of this can occur. So for example, if we look at the ability to understand the substantial effect of any evidence that might be given in support of the prosecution, it might be the case that as that evidence is coming out, the accused person can take it in at sort of a bare minimum level, and then perhaps they need to be given, you know, extra time between that evidence and the next piece of evidence for their solicitors, for example, to explain to them what has happened and make sure they understand it and see if any instructions arise. So it can make things a bit slow, but it is really important to make sure someone understands what's happened. So yeah, it's always a question that is alive about whether someone is fit to stand trial. And every day, conceivably, you might be keeping an eye out to see whether your client can meet that criteria. And it might be that during the trial, an issue of fitness to be tried crops up that wasn't there at the start. Or maybe you were warned by an expert and you've told the court that the person is fit at the time the expert assessed them, but they are concerned that they might become unfit at some stage, but not yet. So for example, if I had a client who was prone to psychosis, perhaps they were really well medicated at the start of the trial, but over the course of it, for whatever reason, the medication wasn't as effective, their condition deteriorated, and it became clear that they couldn't take in what was going on. Well, at that time, could they understand the nature of the charge? Maybe not anymore. They've probably already pleaded not guilty to the charge, and the issue of the right of challenge is probably passed by. But can they now understand the nature of the proceedings? Maybe they can't temporarily. Maybe they can't understand the substantial effect of the evidence. Maybe they can't at that time give me proper instructions to make a defense or to answer the charge against them. So this can be a fluid situation. You need to keep an eye on it. One of the key things to do to protect yourself as a lawyer and also to protect your client's interests, so that you can have a bit of a warning about maybe this might crop up, is to get a good expert report quite early on in your matter, before any trial, before any substantial decisions are made, so that you know that if your client is giving you instructions, they actually understand what's going on and you can rely on those instructions. Or if there is a real issue arising about whether they're fit to plead and fit to be tried, you can raise that nice and early with the court. So as I said, this isn't one of those really exciting, oh my gosh, were they an automaton? Were their actions voluntary? Were they sleepwalking? It's not that kind of question. It's not about were they insane when they committed the offence? No. It's just quite simple. Can they understand the charge against them? Can they follow the proceedings? Can they do other certain things? And as I said, it's an issue that doesn't go away. It stays alive. As a lawyer, I've got to keep my eyes peeled for it quite a lot of the time. And as I said also, I'm often really surprised by the results that come back from psychological testing, neuropsychological testing in particular, because that's looking at people's cognitive function. As I say, a lot of people are very reluctant to reveal the extent of their impairment. They just want to do their best out in the world, and they're also sometimes embarrassed. And so it is really important. In addition to building a good rapport with your client and listening carefully, it is really important to seek the advice of experts when you need them for this particular type of issue. So again, I'll deal with experts in a later episode. Thank you very much for listening to the Not Just a Lawyer podcast. I hope you have found it interesting, and again, I'll be talking about the issue of experts in a later episode, and I think you'll find that really interesting. Thanks again for listening. Bye-bye.